Let me take this opportunity to introduce myself. I am that weird creature that you sometimes read about called a Class A trustee in service to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a member of the fellowship, and none of our panelists here are. We're all judges from various jurisdictions. Before we begin, I'd like to ask for a moment of silence in gratitude for the many miracles, the millions of people who have found recovery through the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. In a few moments, I'm going to introduce our three distinguished panelists today. But before doing so, let me explain to you what we're doing here. If I'm asked one question as a Class A trustee, the most frequent question I am asked is why? Why do you give up your time, Judge Flotus, to serve this fellowship? And it has to do with a couple of points. First and foremost, I've been a judicial officer for 23 years. And in the 23 years that I've been a judge, I've sent thousands of people to this fellowship. And never at any one time did AA ever ask for anything. They accepted with open arms all the alcoholics I sent to them. And in many, a great many occasions, those men and women found a new life as a result of the hard work done by this fellowship. But on a more personal note, I can tell you that about 20 years ago, while calling a DUI calendar in my hometown of Santa Maria, California, which is about halfway between Santa Maria and San Francisco on the Pacific Coast, I had a young man come into my court. His blood alcohol content was 0.46. Now, those of you who are unfamiliar with alcoholism and driving might be surprised to know that the legal limit in California and throughout the country is 0.08. So this young man comes into my court. He was 19 years old. He had a 0.46. He had rolled his car, caused a lot of damage. And one of the things and one of the reasons why we have four drug court judges here, one moderator and three speakers, is because the whole drug court concept, and we're working with persons in addiction and alcoholism recovery, is that we try to make things better for each. Every individual looked at individually, and we try to treat the person, in their unique, with their unique needs. So this young man comes in, 19-year-old, 0.46. He walks in out of custody, and I remand him to the custody of the county sheriff. I said, you need to get into residential treatment. You need help, blah, 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 blah. The public defender agreed. Probation agreed. The sheriffs, everybody agreed. He didn't agree. So not everybody agreed. Several months went by, and the young man walks into my court and asks the bailiff, can I speak to Judge Flores? I'd like to talk to him. And in my court, we have a no-holds-barred policy. You come and talk to the judge. You know, I'd rather you talk to me in my face and say it behind my back. So he walked into court, and he said, you remember me, Judge? I said, no. He said, I was the .46 DUI. I said, well, son, I don't remember your face, but I remember your case. And he said, today's my first year of sobriety. And I wanted to give you my one-year chip. And he handed it to me, and I have it there on my bench. I look at it every day. Now, that really struck a chord with me, even though I've been sending people for years before and a long time after to this fellowship. But the immense power that judges can have in helping shape the life of an individual at need. Some of you in this room were probably sent here and found your way to the fellowship through AA. This is probably the one and only time you're going to be in front of four judges and not be scared to death. So we have three very distinguished panelists to speak with you today about their relationship to AA, what they do as drug court judges, what drug courts are about. And then I'm going to have some individual questions for each of them, and I'm going to ask them to respond to these questions, some concerns that may have come up. And time permitting, I'd like to, leave it open for some questions from the audience. Now, this is not traditional, but I mean, when I did this presentation in Toronto 5 years ago, before I knew what the heck I was doing, and before I knew what this was all about, we had some great questions from the audience, and I wanted to try to replicate that if possible. So if you have some questions, I'm going to ask you to wait until the end of the presentation. We'll try and set aside a few minutes for that. First of all, from Baltimore, Maryland. Judge Jamie Houston, she was appointed in 1999. I strike that. I'm not in court. You like that? Will the reporter please read that back to the court? Thank you. Judge Houston is the presiding judge of the adult drug court. And she was formerly an assistant state attorney. She sits on the board of directors, and I have the privilege of working with her in the National Association of Drug Court Professionals Board. She's a graduate of the University of Maryland, and she went to the University of Baltimore. And this, she's sitting to my immediate left. Please give Judge Houston a big round of applause. Judge Christine Carpenter, sitting to her immediate left, was appointed in 1999. She's a drug court judge, mental health court judge, and she hears a general criminal and civil docket, graduate of the University of Missouri in Columbia and Columbia School of Law. And she's also a faculty member with the National Drug Court Institute. Please give Judge Carpenter a big round of applause. Last but not least, the judge sitting to my far left, he actually had the longest distance to travel here today. He's a judge here in San Antonio, Texas. He's the presiding judge and the founder of the... Now, I have to tell you, Judge Alonzo, it cracks me up because we are in Bexar, B-E-X-A-R County, but I got family that live here and they call it Bear County. This is Bear County. What kind of... So he's a founding judge of the Bexar County Drug Court, a graduate of Trinity University, and a Juris Doctorate degree from St. Mary's Law School, and he has a Master's in Judicial Studies from the National Judicial College at the University of Nevada in Reno. He's board certified in criminal law since 1975, and was the former president of the Texas Association of Drug Court Professionals. So please give Judge Alonzo a big round of applause. At this time, I'm going to ask Judge Houston to come and talk to us a little bit about her experiences as a drug court judge, what drug court is, and then when she's done, we're going to let Judge Carpenter continue.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Jamie, and I am a friend of AA. I love that. People don't do that in court at all. I have to tell you, I am so humbled to be here. This is an extraordinary crowd and group of people. This pales only in comparison to an experience I had a couple weeks ago when my little first grade nephew invited me to come and speak to his class, you know. I guess he figured, you know, Judge Jamie didn't have anything to do, you know, she'll come to class. Gave this speech, and the teacher had all the kids line up, and they were so cute, and I'm shaking everybody's hand, and finally I said to this one little girl, "So, did you learn anything? What did you think?" And she, just as only children can do, looks me straight in the eye, and she says, "Boring!" But you really have to love children, you know, and their honesty. So my nephew, who was appalled, you know, I mean, at 6 years old, 7 years old, he really understood how, you know, little shocked I was. It might have been because I fell over. And he said, "Don't worry, Aunt Jamie. She just repeats everything she hears." So with that, I hope I'm not too boring to you, but don't tell me if I am. In my former lifetime, I was a drug prosecutor, and during that time, I worked with sheriffs and local police departments, state police, DEA, FBI, AT&F, ABC, you name it, I worked with them. I did raids, I did wiretaps, I was in and out of houses, I had so much fun doing that. Down and dirty with the guys, you know. I prosecuted one pill dealers to major kingpins. I worked with community groups, developing legislation to help them. I did radio programs to fight drug usage, substance abuse. I worked on a video for school kids that goes around the country. I did a doctor-lawyer program into the schools. And then I left all of that fun, and I went to the bench. I was a little years old when I went. Needless to say, it wasn't 99. I actually had been on the sitting judge for 20 years. I was 12 when I took the bench. As I heard at the recent convention, a great judge said, "I'm so old, the earth was still cooling at the time." So that was great. But I want you to know that after all that, I was shortly after I became a judge, a couple well-meaning people decided we should start a drug court in Baltimore. And they go, Judge Jeannie will do it. And I think they targeted me because of the, maybe it was the Grateful Dead poster in my chambers. And then to seduce me to do that, they said, let's take her down to Florida, where the first drug court was. And one of my friends, Judge Fogan, had started his drug court. He's in the audience with us today. And they go, yeah, let's take her to Florida. She'll want to go to Florida. What they didn't tell me, it was in the summer during a heat wave. But anyway, that was 16 years ago. And I've been a drug court judge ever since, and I still run our drug court. And now I run all of the problem-solving courts in Maryland, including DWI courts. I'm also a full-service judge. I do a gazillion billion cases in every type of area, including domestic violence, nuisance, landlord-tenant, DWI, drugs, alcohol, you name it, I do it. And I'm pretty convinced that about 90% of all the cases that come across my courtroom are drug and alcohol-related. And I'm pretty much send about 90% of them to AA and NA meetings. But with everything that I've done in my past, I can tell you that the thing that has most made my career most rewarding is helping substance abusers regain their life. And I am extraordinarily overwhelmed, but you all are a phenomenon. I knew I was in the midst of a phenomenon yesterday when I got on the plane and the attendant said, welcome you all to Flight 604, which is the amazing AA, AirTran, FOB, you know, rent a bill, Airbus. And the plane was full of you all. And I heard extraordinary stories, amazing stories. But I hear these stories every day in my courtroom, stories of tales of horror and heartache, dysfunctional backgrounds, people who have lost jobs, lost their kidneys, people who have lost their eyes, who have lost their limbs from diabetes that they're not taking care of because of substance abuse, people who are living in abandonments during this time. And I remember one, like Judge Flores, I remember one gentleman, his name was Edward, and he came to court. He had been involved in drugs and alcohol since he was 14. Since he was 10, a heavy user by 14. By 15, he had run away. By the time he was an adult, he had 33 convictions, been in 23 institutions, and every single place in Maryland, every governor had welcomed him with open arms into their institution. He had committed every crime, except one, he told me, which was prostitution because nobody would buy it. So he was in front of me for a hit-and-run and DWI, his multiple DWI, and he had a 4.1. So I guess your guy got the award. 4.1 was pretty shocking to me. And I decided he needed a little bit of jail time, you know, cooling down time. And he said to me, Judge, I know you are concerned about me, and that's why you're giving me a little bit of jail time, but I wish you wouldn't care so much. Once we got past that, got him out of jail, I then gave him treatment and AA meetings. And extraordinarily, about a year and a half later, a bell whispers in my ear during court. He goes, there's somebody here to see you. I go, yeah, the whole courtroom wants to see me. No, you want to see this guy. So I brought him up to the bench, and he goes, Judge, do you remember me? You're 4.1. He goes, what? What? What are you talking about? I didn't remember his name, but I did remember the 4.1. He said, you know, I wanted to come here and thank you. You saved my life. And he said, I'm married now. I'm taking care of my children. I have a job. And he said, you really just turned this around for me. And he said, I didn't want to go into treatment. I didn't want to go to AA meetings. You know, and it's crossed my mind many times about forcing people to have to go to treatment and to AA meetings. Because I don't want to send them to you when people don't want to be there. And I get that. I really do. But it turned his life. Because, see, you and I are like gardeners. We have to plant seeds. We have to hope that at some point they get it. And he did. He got it. And I asked him, well, what was most helpful? And he said, well, treatment was good, but he said, AA is still in my life. I go every day, and it's keeping me straight. And I thought, okay, I did good here. And I invite people to come back to see me all the time. And this guy, you know, he really takes it to a new extreme. He said the bailiffs will go, here he is again. Here's your partner. And he said to me, he'll say to me, Judge, we are like partners now. You know, we're like married. I'm not ready to get divorced from you yet, so I'm going to keep coming back. So come on down. There are many poignant stories that we see. And I don't have a story to tell you, like each and every one of your stories. I want to get me a story, but I won't get one. I won't. But I'm going to tell you instead. I promise. I won't go out and get one. But I want to tell you about Sherry. Sherry came in front of me, who had been actively using for many, many years. When she came to court, she was strung out. Her hair was stringy. Her eyes were sunken. She was a wreck. Poly user. She had been using alcohol and drugs for years. Her kids were in foster care. She was homeless. And I said, that's it. You know, we're getting you into treatment. You're going to AA meetings. And I surrounded her with a lot of support. And she begged me over the course of about a year to violate her. I can't do this. Let me go. The jail time's easier. And I said, honey, you're mine. You are stuck with me like glue. I'm not letting you go. And I refused. I held on to her, kicking and screaming, until she got sober. And I gave her the double whammy of treatment and AA meetings. And when she came back, when she was finished, successfully finished her probation, I gave her a hug. She gave me flowers. She said, you know, I've never given anybody flowers who's given me jail time. I said, ain't this great? And she was an interesting person because she's a poly user. So where do I send her? NA, AA, both? And so what we did with her, like I do with most of my folks, is I look at their assessment. I ask them what their drug of choice is. And I look at their background to see what is really the driving force in their life. For her, it was alcohol, so that's where I sent her. And that's what I do with most. Because many of my folks are not pure or the driven, it's not one or the other, it's a mixture. So you have to make that hard decision. But that situation was kind of like drug court or DWI court, where we just hugging everybody. It's a hug-a-thon. They hug me and I hug them. We hug the jail guards, the maintenance guy who came through. Everybody's getting a hug there. And it's a really extraordinary experience in drug court because it's creative and it's holistic. And we're trying to wrap around all of our services and our support in a meaningful way so that they have the support like you give to folks. I want to make a difference when people are in front of me because words have power. So I'll say, stop drinking. Then I'll say it lower. Stop drinking. And then I hear organ music, and the sun starts shining on me, and you know, celestial beings come down. And that's how it seems to me. But oddly, I don't think anyone else is hearing any or seeing any of this. And certainly not the defendant. They're not hearing anything I'm saying, kind of like my children. And so I have to find those buttons. I have to nudge and budge them in the 2.5 nanoseconds that they're in front of me. And I realize I cannot do it alone. I need help. I need a team. And AA is a very powerful team member to have on. I rely greatly on AA. And thank goodness you don't have judges' hours. I mean, you're open on Sundays and Saturdays and rainy days and sunny days, and you're always there for people. It's constant. It's steady. AA is open and supportive. You help anyone in need, and your fellowship is dynamic. And judges, I cannot do this without you. And the one thing that I am really convinced about AA is that you really love your coffee. And I know this because I don't send my folks to anywhere I don't go. And so I go to my treatment providers' meetings. I go to my acupuncture places, and I go to AA meetings. I was there last month to an AA meeting, and I heard extraordinarily potent and powerful stories. A lady once said there, I plan my recovery, and I guess I plan my relapse, too. And that really stuck with me. And I went about a month ago when I was at the NADCP conference, the drug court conference. That was a really big conference. There was 3,000 people there. The fact that you have 50,000 people is an extraordinary tribute to AA. It speaks of your mission. It speaks of your power, of your organization, of the motivation. I am so overwhelmed by the elegant simplicity of AA, but don't confuse that with it being easy. Your fellowship is robust and potent, and you are always there to help people in need. And you've walked a mile in their shoes. Who better to show one the path? So you inspire me to continue my walk. You energize me to go and share your stories at home and to continue your passion and your tireless efforts. I am so thankful for what you do. I'm even humble. A judge just said that. And so I hope you find me. I hope you share your stories, because I told you I don't have one myself. And I want to hear your own stories. I think they're extraordinary. They're passionate. They show the endless miles that you've walked to get here. And you've walked that path. You've become whole. You've renewed your spirit. And you've become people of character. So I will quote to you Booker T. Washington, who once said, "Success is measured not by your position in life, but by the obstacles that you have overcome to reach that position." So this is a room full of success. Thank you all.
I had to give Jamie a hug after that. See that? Because we're, you know, one of the things about drug court judges, we are hugging judges. We just hug, you know. Thank you for that. And we're going to have an opportunity to hear from all of our panelists in just another minute. But please welcome Judge Carpenter.
Hello. Hello. My name is Christine, and I am a judge. You don't know how hard it is to admit that sometimes. I wasn't always a judge. I used to be a normal person. I didn't go to law school until I was 30 years old. I had a young son, and I was divorced, and I had a degree in art history, which I didn't think was going to get me too far in central Missouri. And the lawyer who had done my divorce was an idiot. And I really thought I could do a lot better. So I went to law school, took my three-year-old son with me most of the time, and we got through law school together. He's now 36. And strangely enough, never wanted to become an attorney. So that's no surprise. When I went to law school, I knew that I wanted to do criminal law because I thought it was interesting. And I thought it moved quickly, and I thought that it would be exciting. And when I finished law school, I became a prosecuting attorney, and I did a lot of DWIs. And when I did DWIs, it was easy. I looked at the police report, and I checked, was there an accident? Was there a fatality? Was it a one-car accident? Did they leave the scene? Did they take a breath test? What was it? What were their priors? Were they cooperative with law enforcement? And I went through my little checklist, and then I would say, okay, it was a one-car accident. He blew a .14. He doesn't have any priors. He was polite and cooperative. He'll have a 30-day suspended sentence. He'll be on probation. I mean, it was a formula. It's just a formula, and that's the way we did it. And I didn't look at the people. I never saw the people until we were in court, and the case was hopefully being pled out. It was just a formula. After I was a prosecuting attorney, I became a defense lawyer, which is like most of the time what successful prosecutors do. They go out to make some money after they have been a prosecutor for a while. In prosecuting, it was all about the formula. In defense, it was all about how much money do you have. And maybe a few of you have had an experience with that. When you speak to your attorney, and you say, I need a lawyer, and probably the first thing you talk about is money. And a lot of my clients were the kind of clients who gave new meaning to the word laundered cash. They would literally bring me wet money that had just been through the washing machine, because God knows where it had been before they decided to launder it. And, you know, that's how I was making a living. And again, I was defending drug cases, DWI cases, multiple DWI cases, murder cases. anything. I can remember one time being in a murder trial, and when we went on break, I went downstairs to the other courtroom to work on a speeding ticket with a guy. So I covered the gamut in criminal law. In 1999, my town, which is Columbia, Missouri, home of the Big Ten wannabe football team, decided that a drug court would be a good idea. And one of the other judges got it going for a few months, and then I went on board as an appointee to work in the drug court. I didn't know what a drug court was, but it sounded like a good gig, so I said, I'll do this. I was lucky to get the job, and I was looking forward to it because, frankly, I was tired of taking dollar bills and $20 bills and $100 bills that smelled like Clorox. So I'm now on the bench in 1999, and I'm working with drug court. It was a very small court at the time. And if you know much about drug court, and I'm going to assume that some of you know something, but I'll give you some basics. We started out many years ago with the diversion model of drug court, meaning if you were a youthful first-time offender, nonviolent, no weapons, no dealers, and you like to smoke weed, you could come to drug court. When we first started our drug court, we wouldn't take anybody with heroin or meth. If there were any weapons involved, if there were any sales involved, you could forget about it. If you had priors, you couldn't come. So we were getting a lot of really easy cases. We were mostly getting college kids who were, you know, dealing in a small way, but mostly just users and abusers and maybe addicts, but maybe not. I mean, we were getting the really easy cases. Drug court has come a very long way since that time. And we now understand that the people that we really want to be involved with are the high-risk, high-needs people, people who have multiple convictions, people who may have had a gun with them when they were arrested, people who have heroin addictions and methamphetamine addictions, people who have a co-occurring mental illness, people who have been through the system. And I can remember the first time I had a guy who was about 45 years old who'd had multiple prison sentences and been down the road, and he was coming to drug court, and I thought, what are we going to do with this guy? How is our model going to work for someone who's so far into his addiction and so far down the road in criminal justice? And it has been incredibly gratifying to me to realize that a lot of those folks come to me and say, you know, I'm just tired. I'm ready. This is what I need, and this is what I want. And those have been some of our biggest success stories. Frankly, the younger folks are the harder ones to reach because their life is still out in front of them, and they think it's all going to be roses, and they can't sometimes grasp where they're taking themselves on their road in addiction. So we have a drug court. We also expanded our program to a mental health court. I thought it was going to be just like drug court, only a little wackier. Very different, extremely different population. And we have found that we get a lot of people who come into the program, and we're sort of trying to figure out which program they should be in. Should they be in drug court or mental health court? Once we get them clean and sober for a while, it becomes very apparent that they were self-medicating and that they have a mental health diagnosis and they need to be in the mental health court. We freely transfer people from one court to the other if we find that their presenting problem seems to be more prevalent one way or the other. I think it was another limitation of drug court in the beginning when a lot of drug courts, and some still say, we don't want anybody in our court that's mentally ill. Well, that's screening out an awful lot of people. And if you want to exclude anybody that has any kind of mental health diagnosis, you're going to have a pretty small court. So we had to learn how to provide treatment for a co-occurring disorder, for someone who might have severe depression and who's self-medicating with alcohol or with something else. And so we learned a lot about that. Then we moved on and expanded our court to a reentry program, and that's where we got into the folks who were, like I said, the more experienced players in the criminal justice system. And these are people in our jurisdiction who are coming back from prison. The judges can keep a jurisdictional hold on somebody for 120 days. They go to prison for 120 days and receive treatment. And then they come out, and we have a seamless transition from the Department of Corrections into our program. They never hit the street because the vast majority of the folks on their 121st day, when they do hit the street, hit the same street, and they know exactly where to go to get high. And so they never go to the street. They come straight into the program, and we transfer them into an approved home plan after it's been checked out and after they understand that they're going to be tested on a regular basis. Testing is a pretty much of a bedrock foundation of our program. And, you know, it's been interesting to learn that it doesn't matter when someone presents with their drug of choice, whether it be cocaine or marijuana or meth, they learn very quickly that cocaine is out of your system in a few days, marijuana is out in 15 days, but alcohol is out in 12 hours. So they can come to court on a Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock, and they might have their test that day, and then they think, well, I'm good for at least 24 hours, so I could drink a six-pack. And even if I have to take a test tomorrow, I'm still going to be okay if I drink fast enough. So we're very involved with alcohol treatment, and we don't make a whole lot of distinction in drug of choice. I mean, we tailor our treatment programs to drug of choice, but we always realize that someone with a substance abuse problem is not really that picky. And I hear sometimes, I mean, when I've got somebody who says, oh, I say, is there anything you want to tell me? And they go, what? And I go, is there anything you want to tell me? And I leave the door open because I'm pretty sure I know what they've done. They know what they've done. It's just a matter of getting them to tell me. But when I realize that I have particularly young people who are still going to parties that, where there's a bowl full of pills and they're taking a handful and they don't know what they're taking, it's not going to bother them to drink when they really think what they want to do is smoke weed. So we it's an all-encompassing problem. AA for us is a vital part of what we do in our program. We have a lot of requirements for people who are in drug court and in our other courts. We've also now started a DWI court. And again, it's a unique group of folks with unique needs and treatment requirements. But as I said, testing is a big part of what we do. I mentioned my oldest son, who's 36 now. I also have twin boys who are 28, and my youngest is 24. All boys. I thought I knew a lot about urine. Until I started working with drug court, and then I learned a whole lot more about urine than anybody had ever given me any clue that there was to know. We test a lot, and we test, there's three words that you need to know when you're testing in drug court, and that's random, frequent, and observed. And it's the observed part that gets most people. But observed in drug court means observed. And, you know, I always laugh when I hear about drug testing going on in Major League Baseball or down at the Chrysler plant. Basically, they say, next Tuesday, you're going to have a test. Take this bottle and go in that room and come back with something in it. And that's it. You know, anybody could beat that test. So our tests are a lot different, and we're very careful with them. We also, you know, I'll tell you one of the, everybody makes jokes about NA or AA and coffee. You know, we have a real problem with dilute tests, and we have a lot of folks who get up in the morning and drink two pots of coffee before they leave the house. You might be familiar with that concept. And that leads to a dilute drug test, which causes problems for them and for us. So we have to modify a lot of behavior, including some of the behavior that wouldn't necessarily be a problem in other venues. You know, that's what we do in drug court. We provide a supervised, treatment-based, structured alternative to incarceration. We're very successful. And when I say we, I mean the participants. I have people come to me a lot after they've completed the program and thank me. And we all have our stories. You know, we all, I mean, I was in court the other day and a man came up and I saw some car seats, you know, on this back in the courtroom. And I said, what you got back there? And he signaled and his probation officer and his wife carried up two of those big bucket things now that you carry babies in. And it was his twin sons, who were 3 weeks old. And he brought them up to me. And, you know, I reached over the bench and held this 5-pound baby. And that's, what price do you put on that? I mean, he is clean and sober. He is writing about how to be a father. He's living how to be a father. He's doing it. And we're rebuilding families by providing the structure of drug court. When people come to me and say, you cared about me when I didn't care about myself, that's very powerful. And that beats the hell out of getting a lot of cash from a drug dealer as a defense lawyer or from chalking up convictions as prosecuting attorney. It also beats being what we call a normal judge, which is just processing cases, sentencing people, putting them on probation, putting them in jail, just kind of going through the routine. I have to do that some, too. Normally on a Friday afternoon, I'd be doing about 50 preliminary hearings, and I would just be processing cases. That's not the best that we can do. I think drug court right now is the best that we can do. We couldn't do it without AA. And we refer people to AA. We understand the limitations, both legal and the limitations that you have in your meetings that you're running for your benefit, and understanding somewhat of the disruptions that can be caused by people who are required to be there and people who are asking for signatures. But let me tell you that we have treatment, but we also want to provide support. And I understand that AA is support. It's not treatment. It's a support network. And these folks need support, whether they know it or not. So we direct them to you, and we put them in your hands. And for the most part, they're received with love and with care. And again, we couldn't do it without you. So as a drug court judge, I have to constantly step back and not believe my own hype. It's not the judge. It's the program, it's the participants, and it's the support of the community, particularly of the AA community. And I thank you very much for what you provide for drug court, and I thank you very much for inviting us to be here to be able to talk to you about it. Thank you.
Judge Flores. Hi, Dottie. I'm in San Antonio, Texas right now, talking about 600 people over here. They're all looking at you real, yeah? I'm on the podium right now, but yeah, could you call another judge? Thank you. All right. That's pretrial services in Santa Maria. I'm on call, and so for 2 weeks out of six, we rotate as on-call judges, and you get a call from the jail to see if there's probable cause to hold somebody in custody. Hang on a second. Oh, just keep them until I get back. What the hell? No, that's not true. I didn't really say that. She's calling another judge. Before introducing Judge Alonso, let me just tell you, I do owe you all of that. I owe you an apology, and that is that Judge Alonso is really not a drug court judge. He has a jury trial starting tomorrow. I need some jurors, and so you're all going to get some. Oh, just kidding. Please put your hands together for Judge Al Alonso.
Thank you, Rogelio. I'm Al. I'm a drug court judge. And it's an honor and a privilege to be here. I'm going to talk to you about an issue, and it's a goal in my life. In fact, it's a mission and a passion, the work that I do. When I first got on the bench, I was frustrated. I preside over a criminal bench, handling mostly DWIs, drug possessions. And whatever I was doing wasn't working. In the year 2001, at the National Judicial College, I talked to an expert that we had there. They got some of the best judges and the best minds and psychologists and psychiatrists that teaches over there. And that's when I first heard about drug courts. And I got a report from American University where it showed a 10-step program talking about the drug court model. And I started implementing those 10 steps. It's a combination, and we've heard about it already, of the judicial model and the medical model working together to trying to change lives. And it works. When I first came, the people thought I was crazy and they laughed at me. And, you know, the traditional system of just locking them up and throwing the key away wasn't working. It was a revolving door. Then I found out that if you give these people a chance and you give them treatment, it does work. And the research shows that we can coerce people into compliance. We can order them to come to your meetings. And I know a lot of them can be a pain. But it takes a while. It takes about 90 to 100 days for your brain even to look normal if you're on cocaine. But we got to get you sober before you can start rationalizing. And the therapy of cognitive restructuring behavior modification and trying to deal with the triggers, then they finally start getting it. I was overwhelmed when this man was about 48 years old. He said, "Judge, thank you for locking me up 180 days. I said, I thought I never would hear that. Man, somebody locked me up 100 days, I wouldn't be a happy camper, you know." But he said that he was in therapy. It was inpatient treatment. First, we start him in outpatient. If they can't do it in outpatient, then we can. Like the death penalty in drug court, you sentence them 120 to 180 days inpatient treatment. He said, "I got out. Every job that I ever had, I got fired because I stole from my employer. Now I'm back together with my wife and I'm back together with my family." So, I mean, there's no more greater work that I think that a judge can do than when you hear cases like that and you can see them turn around. And briefly, to describe this model for you, if somebody tests positive, we try to take the worst of the worst, the most addicted people that we try to deal with. Because the average addicted person commits 200 undetected crimes a year. So these are the ones we want. These are the ones we want to focus on. And when they test positive, then we send them for a screen. If we find out they're high risk, high needs, Judge Carpenter said, those are the ones we want. Those are the ones we want to change. Then they're ordered to go to treatment 2 or 3 hours a day, 3 or 4 days a week. They got to go to AA, NA 2 times a week. They're tested 2 or 3 times a week. And within 24 hours, we can find out if they tested positive. You know, we got that SCRAM. I don't know if y'all are familiar with that SCRAM, that ankle bracelet that tests your alcohol consumption. 24 hours, then they can download it and we can get it. And we get a report in court. So quickly, we have to address them and get them back in court to address this. And traditionally, we revoke them, you send them to jail or prison. That's easy work. But with dealing with these people, it's arduous work. But it's the most satisfying work you can do when you turn. I mean, it's not a silver bullet, but we can help most people. In the year 2002, our drug court team of 10 people, consisting of probation officer, treatment provider that does therapy, case manager, law enforcement, and our whole team went and we visited and we got trained in 3 drug courts throughout the United States. We went to Compton County in California and Fort Lauderdale in Charleston, South Carolina. And each one of those sites, after our training, we had a group of graduates from drug court. And the program's generally about 18 months to 2 years of going to court. I mean, you got to go to court every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks, as you progress, and it's monthly. And over 90% of the graduates said it was AANA. It was a higher power. It was God. Jesus Christ had gotten their lives and those values. I mean, I got goosebumps when I heard that. But I was trying to do the right thing, but I knew I was in the right place doing the right work. Because in my over 40 years involved in the criminal justice system, specializing in criminal law, I have never seen a program more effective and more productive. One of the late young ladies that testified talked about her life with alcohol and cocaine. She was a court reporter, making about $70,000 to $80,000 a year. Lost her job, lost her husband, lost her children. She was in and out of jail, and she got the death penalty sanction, 180 days inpatient treatment. She got out, but she said it was that 12-step program, and God that changed her life. I mean, she would hide in back of dumpsters so her kids wouldn't see them when they went to school. But she got her kids back. She got her job back. She didn't get her husband back. But, I mean, those are the kind of stories that I hear on a weekly basis. And that's what motivated me to do this work. As I said, in my over 40 years involved in the criminal justice system, I have never seen a criminal justice program which is the most intense supervision that we have in our criminal justice system. I mean, it saves lives, it lowers crime, and it saves taxpayers' money. Dr. Harold C. Herschel III, he's an MD and an addiction out of Dallas, states that a 12-step program in and of itself, you might get 30% recovery rate. But if you couple that with cognitive restructuring and behavior modification therapy and treatment, and then you get the judge with their gavel with a hammer, you go or you're going to do some time in jail. And, you know, we start with very small sanctions. We'll start maybe with, if you test positive with community service, maybe 8 hours, 12 hours. And then, but every time you relapse, there has to be a sanction. And we increase the sanction to where if they cannot do it in outpatient, then they go in an inpatient. But Dr. Herschel says that if you couple that with therapy, behavior modification, the 12-step program, and medication, you got Vivitrol that you can take and you don't get the high off of alcohol. You couple that with medication, then you can get 80 to 90% success rate. This is the best work that I do as a judge, you know, trying jury cases, taking pleas and hearing motions and that. But when you can change a life and you can help your fellow being, that is the greatest satisfaction I think that you can have. And thank you for listening. Thank you.
Okay, I have some questions for these judges here, and there are some chairs up here. Those of you sitting in the back, you want to come up and sit down. And I promise I won't call on you. Let me start with Judge Carpenter. Judge Carpenter, there have been several court cases that have held that it is a violation of that a court cannot compel attendance at AA meetings because AA is a religious organization. And there have been cases throughout the country. And so I'm asked this all the time by judges. They say, well, you know what? I can't send anybody to AA anymore. How do you deal with this issue?
Oh, I'm glad he gave me the easy question. Well, there's two words that jump out of that question. One is compel, and the other one is religious. You know, when I told you that we have a structure, we have phases, we have requirements, we have screenings, we have, you know, we've worked for years to sort of get our program into a state where people know what we expect, and we can be consistent in how we react to certain situations. We do have a requirement in our court that all participants attend either AA or NA. I don't tell them which one. I let them choose. I suggest to them that they try both. I suggest to them that they try different meetings. And we are lucky in our town. We have about 55 meetings a week, and so there's a lot to choose from. There's you know, a wide variety of groups and meetings, and they're able to find something that's not only by location and by time of day, but a group that fits them. I don't order it. And the cases that are referred to are, there are cases all over the country that say that it violates the First Amendment to compel someone to attend religious functions. So I'm not compelling them. I'm telling them that they're in drug court. It's a privilege to be in drug court. They're there voluntarily. And if they want to be in drug court, part of what we would like them to do is AA. Of course, they look at me and go, yeah, so you're ordering me to go to AA, right? I said, no, you don't have to go if you don't want to go. He goes, well, if you tell me I want to go, that I want to go, then I want to go. I try to work with people, and I'll tell you that I have very few people who say, I just don't want to do it. Occasionally, again, I live in a college town. I will have young people who tell me they're Buddhists. They can't go to AA because they don't believe in God. What I ask people to do when they have an objection to AA or NA, I ask them to try it out. I say, just go. Go with an open mind. Just sit there. You don't have to talk. Listen to what they offer. Listen to what the other people have to say. See if you can get anything out of it. Part of also what I require in my court is a writing assignment every time somebody comes to court. And we over the years have worked out a number of topics. And I have a lot of AA-related topics. I ask people to write about why would a sponsor be a good thing to have? If they have a sponsor, then what are you doing with your sponsor? If you're going to meetings, why don't you keep a log of your meetings and tell me, you know, what happened in that meeting? What were they talking about? What kind of meeting was it? We encourage people to work the steps. We provide step workbooks for them. Step one, I give them, they do it, they give it back to me. I look at it, I give it back to them. The rest of the steps, I provide the workbooks. I don't ask them to bring them back to me. That's their work. That's something that I'm encouraging them to do. But this is not a compelled thing. The court cases have gone on to hold that you can't compel somebody to go to AA unless there's a secular alternative. So if you have other meetings that are available that are not religion-based, if you have those alternatives available, that kind of gets around the problem of ordering someone to AA. Frankly, the people in my area of the country, Columbia, Missouri, sometimes prefer the more religious groups. They want to go to Celebrate Recovery. They want to be in a more religious environment than what AA provides. And I'll tell you, the final thing that I say to people is, you know, there's a big difference between religion and spirituality. And you don't have to be religious. You don't have to go to church. You don't have to believe in God. But I would encourage you to examine the concept that there might be something out there bigger than you. Whatever that might be, and I'm not going to tell you what it might be, but think of that as your higher power and try to make that work for you. And, you know, we used to be a much more spiritual civilization than we are now. Everybody used to realize that there was maybe something else that was bigger than them. Not so much anymore. So that's all we're encouraging. We're encouraging people to get outside themselves a little bit, to be open-minded, to give the meetings a try. And I can tell you that in 10 years plus, I've never had anybody who gave it a try who said, not for me, I refuse to go. So, thanks.
Judge Alonso, you know, I've been around you people too long. These are questions I get asked all the time, so I get to throw it at these judges. This is great. Many people who you send to us they have their court card signed, they just want to get their card signed and they just take off. What do you suggest? How do you suggest we deal with this problem? You understand our frustration, Judge Alonso? You're sending these people to AA, they want the court card signed, they don't even wait for the end of the meeting and they take off. What should we do about that? Is that a good question or what? Yeah.
Well, here locally, I found the Haven for Hope. We have a $100 million center that was based for the homeless. But we partnered with our drug court. They built a courtroom for us. That's where we hold court. And they have treatment providers there, and they have the probation officers there. I mean, they have doctors 24/7. They're going to have 800 beds when they finish. But also, you get a bar code. And so what we're doing, we're having AANA there. And so with the bar code, they'll give them, and we'll know if they attended or not, and they can tell us. But other than that, you know, if we send them to you, I think what you got to do, try to encourage them. Because traditionally you can say you can lead a horse to water, but you cannot make him drink. But we can make them drink in drug court if we keep them in treatment long enough. Once they've been in treatment long enough, then they'll wake up. And that's where you all need to be a support group for them and help them do that. So.
From the bar to the barcode. That's just like, whoa, that's pretty cool. Judge Houston, some judges have AA literature in their courtroom or in the waiting areas. Is this something that you aren't supportive?
I don't like that question. Can I answer another one?
Yes.
I'm just kidding. I had somebody in court not so long ago whose case was dismissed. Before her case was dismissed, she was jumping up and down and being very histrionic, making a lot of noise. I thought that she was either drunk or something was wrong with her. I was a little concerned. But we just said, you know, your case is over. You're free to go. And she goes, okay. And as she was leaving, she starts handing out literature. I wasn't sure what it was. So I said, ma'am, can't do that in court. She said, but it's the Word of God. And I said, well, I appreciate that, but it's really not the place to be distributing that literature here during court hours. Could you do this outside? And she said, it's the Word of God, and you cannot silence the Word of God. And I responded by saying, for that you are correct, but I sure as well can silence you. Out you go. AA is not religious. It's spiritual. We all know that. We get that. The courts, however, as we just heard, have spoken very clearly that AA, because higher powers can be interpreted as some kind of religious connotation or of another being, cannot be forced on anyone. It violates First Amendment. I take that for what it means, that the literature cannot be in the courthouse. Okay, there's a lot of alternatives. Drug court judges are nothing if not creative. We can put them a lot of other places. We can send people to the right places. We can get them distributed in many other contexts. So I'm not so concerned that it's not sitting in the courthouse. They're going to get it in many, many other contexts. We're going to make sure that they get that. So I'm not concerned about that. I'm not going to violate the judicial edicts that suggest that this literature shouldn't be there. But we make no bones about it by telling them that we want you to go to AA or NA meetings. And for those folks who feel that they cannot do that because they're Muslim or Buddhist or atheist, there are self-help groups in many jurisdictions. I have not checked this out myself, but I understand there are self-help groups online now which are fairly robust that we can also send folks to if they live in small jurisdictions and don't have a lot of alternatives. So we certainly can become creative.
A lot of you have touched on this subject, and this is something that I think is another one of those questions I get asked a lot, and that's the issue of singleness of purpose. So let's talk about that briefly, and then we'll open us up for questions. But do you each know the concept of singleness of purpose? That is to say, do you each understand that AA is for alcoholics and not for heroin addicts and not for methamphetamine addicts and not for cocaine addicts? And yet, I say that with a caveat, and talk about poly-substance users, alcoholics who are also using other substances. Not that anybody here in this room would ever have violated that principle. However, I understand it may happen out there in the real world. And I'm going to start with Judge Alonso this time. Talk about the persons who are, us sending persons to AA who have no alcohol history whatsoever. And do you understand the frustration that AA might have with that, the people in the fellowship might have with that? So do you understand that the AA might be frustrated with drug court judges sending non-alcoholics into the fellowship for meetings?
Well, I think that Judge Carpenter touched on it a bit. If they don't want to go, at least, well, I got a place at the barcode. We're going to find out if they're going. But if they don't want to go, they can get it online, or it can be a secular program that you can. I think there's even local groups in San Antonio where somebody that does not go the spiritual route, that they have an option. As long as we give them, I think we cannot court order them to go, but we can give them the option. And I think they'll have equal protection under the law if we give them that alternative. Also, they have an option not to do drug court. They can do jail, or they can do prison. But that's an option. They can make up their own mind if they want to do it or don't do it. But I mean, all the research shows that the longer we can give them engaged, the longer they can go to treatment, the longer they can go to these support groups, that the outcomes or better the longer they're in these programs.
All right. Judge Carpenter and Judge Houston and Judge Alonso, I'm going to now open this up to questions. You may have a question for these judges here. We're going to start over to the right. Now, I need you to speak up real loud, and I'll repeat your question so the tape can pick it up. But over here with the red and white hat with something on it. Well, and that's an excellent question. The question is, what's the best way for a person to approach judges like yourself if they want to interact with the bench and they're not even in our courts? So how does the fellowship approach you if they have a question they want to talk to you? Judge Carpenter.
Well, you know, one of the things that's really unique about drug courts and drug court judges is that we actually talk to people. And we even touch them sometimes. Typically in court, you come to court, if any of you have ever been to court, you come to court with your lawyer. Your lawyer talks. The prosecutor talks, the defense lawyer talks, the judge says a few things. You stand there. And as a defense lawyer, I always thought that I did my very best job at trying to prepare people when they went to court. This is what's going to happen. This is what we're planning on. This is what you're going to say. This is what they're, you know. And then we would walk out, and I would say, so? And they'd go, what happened? It's just, you know, it's lawyers and it's judges talking in a different language. When you're the defendant, you're scared. I know that lots of times when I'm even talking directly to people, once I say one word, which is usually the word jail, they don't hear anything else. They just don't hear anything else. So drug court, we talk directly to people. They come up to the bench. They're right there. I shake their hand every time they come to court. We talk directly. I ask them if they have questions. If they look confused or are not talking, I ask them what's wrong. We're very approachable. And that carries over out of court as well. So if you are proposing, if you want to work with the drug court, if you want to speak, if you want, yes. Well, I think risk is the active word there. And you have to realize that as a judge, we make decisions on every single case that involve life and death a good deal of the time. They involve making a judgment call on trusting that someone's going to be able to hold it together and not hurt somebody else. And everything that we do is a balance of public safety and of trying to help the individual. And it's very difficult sometimes, particularly with DWI cases, when you have a chronic offender who has 6 or 7 priors, or if you have someone who's been involved in a fatality accident, and you're an elected judge, and you decide to let that person not go to prison, or you even make a decision about letting that person be released on bail, you're taking a big risk. And you're always trying to balance the rights of the individual between the public safety. And that's why a judge is, that's the hardest part of being a judge. You're making that tough call. So sometimes we're right and sometimes we're wrong. Every drug court and probably every other judge's nightmare is the headline that says that the person that you decided to give a chance to went out and hurt somebody else. That being said, I don't run my court based on a fear of headlines. I try to balance each case. We try to educate all the other judges that we're in contact with. We try to have drug court and alternative sentencing options available. We try to make sure that all the judges in the state, not just the drug court judges, know about the concepts of alternative sentencing. But it really does come down to, that's why we choose people to be judges that we choose, because we have to trust them to make those decisions, which are very difficult.
You're next, right here, and then we're going to go this way. Yes. So the question is, have we considered using CPC, cooperation with professional community members, to orient people we're sending into AA? And I can answer that question. And that really depends on the local, judges. I think there's a disconnect. I sit on this board, your general service board, and I sit on the board of directors of the National Association of Drug Court Professionals, and I'm trying to build those bridges so we know how to talk to each other. So AA knows how to talk to drug court judges and vice versa. That's why we're doing this. That's what this exercise is about. Because I think it's really important. Most judges, including a lot of drug court judges, don't know what CPC is. They don't know what H&I is. They don't understand, your structure, your service structure and how that works. But I think that's really a critical component that needs to be done. And the reason why I asked that question, and the question over here from the young man, I think it's profound, because that's the issue. Is the issue is how, you see, judges, all judges, we're all public servants. So we serve the entire public, including AA. So we serve the public. And I think it's important for judges to have an open door policy whenever possible to discuss these matters. My first day on the bench 23 years ago, I had his Spanish-speaking AA group. They were in my chambers. And how the hell did you guys get in here? And they were in there asking me to go speak to their first photo and that. I've got it, you know, 23 years ago. But they knew. They said, you know, we want to talk to this guy. And that's kind of when it all began. But CPC stuff is critical. You know, I agree. So we need to do more of that. In the very back, in the middle here, and then we're going to work around. We've got a few more times. What a concept, huh? You know? Yeah? Teach people not to get DUIs. I'm all for it, but I mean, unfortunately, I mean, I think it's a great question. I'm not being facetious. It's a great question, but I'm going to tell you right now, that's not how the justice system works. You know, we always wait till the toothpaste is out of the tube, and we got all these smart minds over here trying to put the toothpaste back in. It's a big mess, but I love that suggestion. I think it's something we should be looking at. Here, this row has not asked the question yet. First row, right here. Well, the website is allrise, all one word, allrise.org. O-R-G, allrise.org. And it's all the information you need about starting a drug court's in there. Second row.
Unfortunately, there's not a lot of jail-based or prison-based treatment. So, where are you from? My suggestion is we all move there. Sonoma County, for many reasons. That's the one of them. Good one. There's not a lot of jail-based treatment. In Baltimore, we're really fortunate. I have an acupuncture treatment program in the jail. I love it because I'm not sure if you're all familiar that acupuncture is really good for addiction. It's for any addiction, drinking, drugs, overeating, gambling, whatever. And it's actually 5 needles in each ear, and you couple that with treatment, it's pretty dynamic. I've done it 3 times in the jail with my guys and gals. It just puts me right to sleep. It just knocks me right out. But it tells them that they reduce their craving. But it's sporadic. It's jurisdiction by jurisdiction based. It's nothing federally, I understand, there's really no treatment at all. So there's just not a lot out there. And it's a shame because we send people in jail to get them off the street, but who are we sending them with? Bad people. And then we want them to come out and to do good without any treatment, without any training. We want them to be noble and spiritual, but we put them in places where it's dark and dank. And so, yes, I feel the rest of our pain. I'm a believer. We should have jail-based, institution-based treatment.
This is why, you know, my hat's off. Those of you who work in corrections, you know, you guys are taking the message into the correctional facilities is the most stunning work. I equate, I mean, there's nothing more important or less important in AA. There's nothing, you know, I mean, you know, you really can't quantify this stuff, but corrections work is important. And I equate it with 12-step work. It's, you know, for people who are, you know, not in custody. And I mean, it's just the kind of stuff that really the hands-on, loving, nurturing part of this fellowship that keeps me coming back. Back row, please. You haven't got a drug court in New Zealand? I'll talk to you after. I'm going to meet with you folks. We have. See that? You know, Judge Carpenter wants to go to New Zealand. She wants to be on that. See that? We have time for 2 more questions. Let me go, sir, over here, and then you're next, sir. All right. The question is, how are we going to stop the billions and trillions of dollars that are going across the border supporting the cartels in Mexico? I can tell you, and other countries, and I can tell you that really is a huge problem, right? You know, I don't want to. We don't get involved in outside issues. Dang, Judge, you're almost one of us now. Shoot. Having said that problem, because I'm not a member of the fellowship, I can say this. You know, the rest of the world's drug issues are not going to be solved. I mean, their problems are not going to be solved until we solve our problems in this country. That's as simple as that. Yes, sir. Well, you know what, and again, I have to tell you, even though it affects this fellowship greatly, you know, I do believe that the federal district court decisions that have said that AA is, not understanding the difference between spiritual organizations versus a religious organization. It really is it's an outside issue for us, for this fellowship. Having said that, and because I'm not a member of the fellowship, I can say this. A defendant has to affirmatively declare in court that they don't want to go. Well, in my court they don't. They just go. And there's some drug court brochures here from Bahar County here. Folks, we have to close right about now. So wait, don't leave. So here's what I would like to do. First of all, we're available to answer questions afterwards. Come up and talk to us. Don't be afraid of these guys. All right, well, yeah, all right, be afraid of them, but they'll still talk to you. But I want everybody to stand and let's do a big circle around here and let's do the serenity prayer, and then let's close like that.